So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine in Madison. So happy to have Dr. Sandy back, and thank you so much for listening in. If you have questions about your pet's health, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And also, if you want, post a note on our Facebook page. We're checking that, too. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show to do that. Dr. Sandy, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
It is nice to be back.
On a nice day like this. And we have Easter coming up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this is the time of the year that, you know, everybody knows, you know, don't leave chocolate out because that can be, you know, hazardous for pets. And actually, the Poison Control Center has been getting more and more reported toxicity cases with chocolate because we as consumers, if you've noticed the change, I mean, we used to think that, you know, like just a plain old milk chocolate bar was like the mm-hmm. best thing. And now everybody's into this like 70% active mm-hmm. ingredient. And so chocolate that we're buying can be more problematic for your pets. So if your pet gets into chocolate, call your veterinarian and try to, if you can try to figure out how much they got into, perfect, you know. And I think it should be something that every owner has at home is a fresh bottle of hydrogen peroxide, because that's one of the things that we'll use to make a pet vomit. And that would be instructions that your veterinarian or an emergency clinic could be able to give you as to how much, you know, if they know how much your pet weighs, how much to be able to give to be able to get them to empty their stomach. Not a pleasant thing to be, you know, have put down your throat, but there are some toxins that you don't want to make them vomit if they eat them. But, and so that's why you always want to get instructions first. So besides that, and, you know, the standard thing with Easter grass causing issues with, you know, cats licking it and getting it stuck in their bellies, something that a lot of people don't realize is the dreaded Easter lily, very, very toxic for cats. And I just am a big believer that if you own cats, do not even bring an Easter lily or any Asiatic lily into your house or garden, because even small amounts of that can put a cat into kidney failure. So just leave them out of your house. They just have to chew on a leaf and they could get into trouble. So leave that alone. And then the last thing, the whole bunny issue, you know.
Yeah, don't do that.
Keep them chocolate, okay? Not living unless you are really prepared to adopt a bunny. You know, what I'm concerned about is this is also the Chinese Year of the Rabbit. And I was just watching TV and saw something about a new movie out that's called Hop that looked quite cute for families to go to. And so whenever we've got all these things going on, everybody's like, oh, I want a bunny just like that one. But remember, bunnies, they live like 8 or 9 years plus. They need to be spayed or neutered. They need regular veterinary care. They have specific dietary needs. They love to be with people. They don't like to be cuddled. Okay. So, you know, people, you know, especially little kids, they get a bunny and they think, oh, be able to hold on to it. They prefer to be next to you or sitting on the floor with you, but not being picked up. So, I mean, they're a species that is a prey animal. And so when they get picked up, they're thinking that maybe, you know, some big, you know, eagle or hawk has grabbed me, and they may start to struggle. And that's where we run into troubles with people getting scratched and things. So do your homework. Rabbits are now the number 3 pet in the United States being surrendered to humane societies, just behind dogs and cats. So, there's a big problem there.
And, you know, we had the basketball tournament, the NCAA basketball tournament. The Butler Bulldogs did pretty well. I expect Bulldogs are going to be a lot more popular.
Oh, they, you know, and they have been. And that's been the big issue is when we end up with having a dog reaching popularity, people get them and they are doing things with them that they may not realize could be a problem for them. And airlines are getting the brunt of this. Many airlines, and now Delta is the last one to, or one of the latest ones to do this. Last year, in 2010, Delta had 16 pets, dogs, I should say, die while in the baggage hold area. Mm-hmm. And of those, 6 were bulldogs. So it gives you an idea of these pug-nosed dogs really have a hard time breathing. And if they get a little overheated, they could run into serious problems. And we've had for a long time, problems with traveling in the summer months, airlines will not allow pets to go in baggage. But now this is year round. And this is not only just for English bulldogs, but also French bulldogs. And they're even including American bulldogs. So and some have started looking at, you know, pugs and, you know, you name the short nosed breed. Yeah. Just be really, really careful. And if you can drive, there's one pet airline that functions very infrequently out of a single airport going down to Florida. And for people that live on the East Coast, that may be very convenient. But for us here, we're looking at driving.
Driving. Yeah. All right. Jan in Chippewa Falls has a question for you, Sandy. Let's go there. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Recently, well, last February, I adopted a German Shepherd mix. And she is prone to pancreatitis. And I have gotten this Pancre Plus, and I give her 6 tablets a day. And she's on Science Diet for sensitive stomachs. But I feel like she's always on the verge of having an attack. And then I go to the vet and I get the medication. But what can I do to help her? Are there any other?
Yeah, I'm confused in that the pancreas is an organ that has a couple of functions. One of them is to produce digestive enzymes. And so when we have an inflamed pancreas or pancreatitis, as you've called it, that causes the release of all these digestive enzymes, and it can cause severe gastrointestinal signs and even death if it's not treated appropriately. Sometimes it's just abdominal pain and vomiting. It can be very mild, but it can lead to, you know, very severe critical care management type cases. There's another problem that we'll see with the pancreas where they don't make enough digestive enzymes, and that's called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, which means they don't make enough enzymes to digest the food. So the dog eats, and the food just goes through relatively undigested. So you'll see a lot of like greasy stools and so on. The pet loses weight and is hungry all the time. And that's where using pancreatic supplements, like you've suggested, helps with adding enzymes to help with the digestion of the food. Adding enzymes is not going to help a dog with pancreatitis. An inflamed pancreas, you want it, the best thing you can do is get medical attention, hold the pet off of food. If it's a mild case, sometimes just being held off food will do it for a day or two. But sometimes we're looking at IV fluids, sometimes even feeding with an IV line with some, you know, special nutrients and so on, rather than just fluids. They need pain management and so on. So that's why I'm confused. What does your dog have? Is it having actually pancreatitis?
Well, the deal is I got her from a shelter in Illinois, not this recent February, but February before last. And the vet there said in Illinois told me that this kind of breed was prone to pancreatitis, gave me the medication and then this enzyme, and she'd been on the medication, it helped tremendously. And then he said that he didn't want to, and he'd taken a stool sample and checked that out. And then he said that he didn't want her to be on this medication all the time.
Okay. All right. Well, it sounds like she's got more. The condition that we see fairly commonly in shepherds, German shepherds and shepherd mixes, is this pancreatic insufficiency, where they're not making enough enzymes, which is very different than pancreatitis. Pancreatitis usually starts by being fed a real, a heavy, greasy meal. So the dog that gets into the trash and eats a lot of pork chop fat, that can trigger it. Giving gravy to your dog, those kind of things. So usually when we've got a dog that gets his pancreatic inflammation over and over again, we feed them a low-fat diet, very easily digestible with, just try to keep the fat to a minimum. For exocrine insufficiency, it also is helpful to have an easily digested diet, but they have to add in those extra enzymes. So I think either you heard your veterinarian wrong or your veterinarian misspoke. And I'd go back to your veterinarian and say, what does my dog really have? And I think that would be probably the best way to get some answers to your questions. Sorry that I can't help you.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. We got an email from Nancy in Racine. My shampoo costs $4 on sale. My dog's shampoo costs $8 on sale. Does my dog really need dog shampoo, or could he use mine?
Yeah, and that's a good question. And you know what? I can tell you, I use my own shampoo in my dogs. There may be some veterinary dermatologists that are out there listening and going, uh-oh. But, you know, there are cases where, for some reasons, dogs need medicated shampoos, and then that's a different story. If they've got, you know, severe seborrhea issues or chronic yeast problems or skin infections, then you're looking at using a specialized shampoo. But when it comes to just general cleanup, and I think the reason why pet shampoo is more expensive is how often do we wash our hair versus how often do we wash our dog? Okay, so there's a lot more human shampoo sold than there is dog shampoo. You know, I don't think, unless your dog has some special needs, you know, either using a gentle baby shampoo, making sure that you rinse really well. I even like to dilute shampoo down about 1 to 4 with water. It spreads through the hair coat easier. So wet the dog down thoroughly, then dilute the shampoo down and use that instead of full strength so you don't get this big glob of shampoo on your dog's hair coat. But even an inexpensive, you know, flea shampoo, that's what our dermatologist tells people to use for just cleanup. Not that it's going to be repelling fleas or doing anything, but they just tend to be relatively inexpensive compared to some of the fancier ones that are out there.
All right. Let's go to Sherry in Wales. Let's see here. Did I get her on? Yeah, there we go. Hi, Sherry. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question regarding the flea and tick preventatives.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 99-pound German Shepherd, and I have had him on Frontline for the year and a half that I've had him. And I see the commercials for the Canine Advantage, which says that it repels the fleas before they bite.
Mm-hmm.
And every dog I've had, all the vets have always recommended the Frontline, and I'm wondering why that is, if they have to be bitten by the flea or tick for it to work, why they recommend that and what your feelings are on which is better.
Oh, there are so many products out there on the market, and new ones even coming out as we speak. There, just a couple of weeks ago, I got detailed on a new product for fleas that's combined with the heartworm preventative, and you know, so. But if you just want to talk about those two products, Frontline versus Advantix, I assume you're talking about. There is an Advantage product for dogs that only gets fleas. The product that you're probably thinking about is called Advantix. The difference between the two are what's in them. Frontline is a chemical that goes down into the hair follicles and coats the hair as it comes up. It's excellent. It lasts for a good, you know, a good month. But every product, you're going to see some tick breakthrough. And, you know, the tick may attach, but is going to die before there's a chance of spreading any diseases or anything like that to your pet. Usually, it depends on if you put it on right, you use the right dose, and so on. But it is a very safe, waterproof product, you know, and kind of one of the industry standards. Advantix is made by a different company. It contains two different ingredients, one that keeps fleas off the dog, that kills fleas, the other one that controls ticks. And the active ingredient for ticks is called permethrin. And permethrin is found in a number of other over-the-counter products as well as veterinary products too. The issue with that particular chemical is that it is very toxic for cats. And so whenever I have a patient that has dogs and cats at home, if they want to use that product, they need to put it on their dog at night, put their dog in a kennel where it's not going to be able to be sleeping in a spot where the cat's going to sleep or they're going to cuddle up with each other. So it's a little more problematic that way. You have to be very careful with dosing it. But it, again, works very well if it's used correctly. So I think, you know, the other thing, a nice thing about Advantix is that it also, because of the permethrin, repels mosquitoes. So it helps keep mosquitoes off your pet. So if you live in a wooded area, that might be a nice product to keep your pet from getting bit up too. So none of them are identical. They all kind of work differently. And this would be something that you can work through with your veterinarian and find out if they, you know, if they like one over the other. But sometimes it comes down to looking at, you know, who else lives in the house and where you live and if your dog's swimming a lot and all those things before we make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then that was one of my other questions that you kind of answered was about mosquitoes because there are the mosquito-borne diseases now too.
Mm-hmm.
And is the Advantix one waterproof or not?
Yes, it is. Dogs can swim with it on. Yep, no problem.
Okay.
The mosquito-borne diseases, number one, is heartworm, and that's not going to prevent heartworm disease, okay, because you still have to have your dog on a heartworm preventative. The other mosquito-borne disease that we have in this area is West Nile virus that has been identified very uncommonly in dogs. There's been, like, I think, I can't even remember, but like one dog in the last couple of years, I think it was in the Chicago area, that ended up catching it, and it was a dog that was quite medically compromised. So I would not look at that as a huge deal. It may become an issue, but at this point, I think it's more the comfort level of your dog is what we're looking at.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have an email from Wendy. We have a few chickens and are considering a baby pot-bellied pig from a rescue organization. Can you talk about the pros and cons and what we might expect? The hens have a converted playhouse that's heated in the winter. Can the pig live in the backyard with them as an only pig? We'll spend time with him, of course, but don't want him living in the house as some pet pigs do. What are your thoughts?
Pot-bellied pigs they originated in tropical areas. And so they are not designed for our Wisconsin winters, even in if it's got a heated type house or whatever to live in. It's not going to be at room temperature, I take it. They are very social critters. If you get one, assume that it's going to be in your house. They're quite social. I don't think just being friends with a chicken is going to be enough for it. And so if you don't want it in your house, then don't get a pig. I think they're really neat and interesting. I just don't like the feel of them. They're kind of bristly and so on. But people that love their pigs, they have ramps in their house and futons on the floor for them and dog doors that they can go in and out of. And they're quite pampered, similar to like dogs and cats are.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're looking at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Lots of callers online, so let's go back to the phones here. Sandy and Debbie and Delafield up next. Hi, Debbie.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have three cats that I own. One is a 20-year-old female who doesn't like anybody but keeps to herself. And the other two are brothers, and they're about 6 years old now. And we're looking to have my daughter's cat move in with us. I'm a little worried about integrating these cats together because my two males, though they're neutered, and indoor cats, they're very aggressive.
Okay.
They freak out when they get on the porch and another cat happens to come through the yard, even to the point where if they get really riled, they'll attack each other.
Oh, my goodness. So they're redirecting their aggression at each other. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I mean, they don't hurt each other, but I'm afraid it could get that way.
Yeah. And here, it's really good that you're thinking about this before you just bring the cat in. You've already, shown that your two cats are not super social. I mean, they like each other, but, a new cat coming in could create a lot of stress in their life. Whenever you bring a new cat in, you always want to keep them separated, totally separated, where they can't see each other behind a closed door, no chance of having a door open and the cat running out. So they can just get used to the smells of each other. And maybe they can hear each other. And until the two boys are like, we'll walk past the closed door and go, oh, there's another cat on the other side. And I'm really curious to see who's in there. And you can tell by their body language if they're stressed or not. Then you don't take it to the next step. The next step would be letting them see each other through a crack in the door, or sometimes we'll even do things like take two cat toys and tie them together with a string and have one on either side of the door and they can kind of play tug back and forth, things like that. Sometimes taking a towel or a blanket that the cat's been sleeping on and exchanging it into another spot of the house where the two cats, they can get to know each other that way by exchanging odors.
Mm-hmm.
You may never, ever get them integrated. So always stop and think, can I live in a house divided? Because this may be...
This is a temporary thing.
Okay.
Probably for 6 months to
then a year. I would just probably, if that's the case, keep them separated. There's not even a reason to go through all of this. I would just say, let's just keep them separated. But if you find that, yeah, after a few weeks or a few days, whatever, it can take sometimes months, but depending on the cats, if they get used to each other, then maybe let them, you know, see each other, but do it slowly. Always increase your resources. You've got three cats now. You're adding a fourth. You should have at least five litter boxes in five different locations in your home.
I already have four.
Okay. Well, you can add in another one. Okay. And then multiple feeding stations, increase space vertically, lots of cat trees and things where the new cat or the old cats can get up out of the way. And that sometimes helps by expanding their territory rather than putting an addition on your house. Think vertically. It may or may not work. Plug in some feel away. That's that feline.
I was about to ask about that.
Whether it's going to help or not, who knows? But you know, it's $25. It's worth a gamble. You know, yeah. I don't. Yeah, it's about approximately what it costs. So plug that in, and maybe it might help. But
in both locations.
Yeah, definitely.
I would. Daughter's cat is a little aggressive, also.
Oh, so.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. We've got three boys that are going to be fighting for supremacy.
Oh, my goodness.
Is there another place where this kitty could go?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to keep the other cat in the basement. We have a finished area in the basement. But they will be able to stick their paws underneath the door.
And you may find that may just be enough stress to start causing your two boy cats to start urine marking, fighting with each other. You know, they may become so stressed that they start developing some, behaviors like over-grooming and things like that. So just be prepared. I would be looking at, with your history, finding another home for the cat rather than you taking your daughter's cat in.
Yeah, there you go, Debbie. That's the word. We'll turn to Julia in Mondovi next. Hi, Julia.
Hi. We have a Yorkie Terrier about 2 years old. And I noticed when we had brought him back from the groomer, we usually keep him short. He doesn't have a long coat, and she shaves, you know, the tips of his ears, that on the inside it felt a little crusty. So then when I turned it over, I noticed there were some patches of, you know, a little crust. I'm wondering if that's yeast or what. He has it in both ears.
Okay.
And I just never noticed that before, but, you know, I could kind of feel it on the outside of the ear. You know, it was a little bumpy.
Yeah, yeah. So it's on the outside part of the ear?
No, on the inside.
Inside part of the ear. Okay.
Yeah, on the
inside. First thing I would do is, if you've got a good groomer, most skin issues, if you're taking your pet to a groomer, they're going to see it. They're going to say, hey, your dog's got, you know, this going on. You should see your veterinarian. Or I found this new lump while I was trimming. See your veterinarian. So contact your groomer. There may be some notes or records or something there to say what was in the ear. So that would be number one, contact your groomer. But yeast infections in the ears usually are down in the ear canal, and they're usually greasy, kind of a dark brown, greasy discharge. And if you sniff the ear, it kind of smells like an old tennis shoe type smell. But this little crusting on the ears, I'm wondering, did your dog get, you know, have the, you know, ears, the hair trimmed there, and did they get a little clipper burn and caused a little abrasion? Again, that would be something your groomer would be able to inform you of. And if they said they did give your dog clipper burn, I might be looking for a new groomer. So, because especially if they didn't report it to you.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
Yeah, and then if they, you know, if you can't figure it out that way, then take your dog to your veterinarian, let them have a look.
Yeah, absolutely. Terry in Oconomowoc has a similar related question in a way. She says, I have a 16 weeks old English Springer Spaniel puppy, had a yeast infection in both her ears. We treated it with Mometamax, but now that smell has returned. Should we try another course of that, or is there a different treatment we could try?
Yeah, Mometamax is one of those once-a-day medications that has lots of different drugs in it. It's got a steroid, it's got a very potent antibiotic, and it also has an antifungal agent in it. And for puppies, it's common for puppies to have yeast overgrowth in their ears. Usually they're not itchy, they're not bothering their ears, but they get some yeast overgrowth. So rather than, if your dog isn't being bothered by it and it's just the odor, I'd be looking at using a good otic or ear cleaner. There are many of them on the market. Your veterinarian probably has their favorite one. The ones that we use in the clinic are either a product called Epiotic, which is really good for greasy, healthy-looking ears that are just greasy and need to be cleaned. There's a very gentle one called Otocleanse, and there's many, many other ones on the market. But getting a good ear cleaner may be all you need to do if your dog isn't clinically affected.
There we go. And on to Lynn in Evansville, Wisconsin. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, and thank you both so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question revolves around an old-timer, an 18-year-old cat that I recently brought to the vet, suffering from mild weight loss and diarrhea. And his weight loss, even though he was eating, I would give him custom feeding. Tests revealed renal insufficiency. His stool test was negative. And the vet recommended a renal cat food that he usually eats only wet. So we have tried KD and Royal Canin, but both are pork-based, which he does not find a solution. He doesn't find them palatable. So
there is a Royal Canin chicken formula.
Oh,
too.
There is.
Yeah, and that may be something that your veterinarian just may not stock,
right.
But you can request that, and they could probably order a bag to see if that works. So they make this the kidney diet in a pork or in a chicken formula.
Now, is that true for wet as well? Because he doesn't do dry.
The wet, I'm drawing a blank on, but I know it's available in either like a pate and then like little, like almost like the Fancy Feast type size cans that are more like the little bits with gravy.
Gotcha.
So there's a couple of different forms of canned available as well. But what I'm concerned about is the kidney disease could potentially cause weight loss, but kidney disease shouldn't cause diarrhea. Okay. You may see weight loss, you may see them drinking more and urinating more, but diarrhea is not associated with kidney disease.
And it's almost liquid, and it's been true for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
He thought it was because I was feeding him too many different kinds of food. That was to improve. He only eats a little at a time, so I would give him what he wanted.
Yeah, and it's possible, but I still think that there's, you know, and if your cat truly has renal insufficiency, which is very different than renal failure. Okay,
right.
So that's kind of the beginning of kidney disease. Mm-hmm. Usually cats with the beginning of kidney disease, the owner doesn't even know they're sick. We just happen to see that they're not concentrating their urine as well. Maybe the puddles in the litter box are a little bit bigger, but the cats are usually feeling pretty good. When they have renal insufficiency, the kidney toxin levels haven't started to be elevated yet. So they're still feeling good. They're just drinking more and urinating more and having a little more trouble maintaining their hydration. Once we get into renal failure, then you can start seeing appetite change and they can start, you know, not feeling well and not want to eat. So I'm wondering if there's something else going on with your cat. A couple of things. I don't know if your veterinarian looked into hyperthyroidism, but I hope that they did a thyroid level. Sometimes cats that have thyroid conditions that are producing too much of that thyroid hormone will lose weight and sometimes even have diarrhea and so on. So make sure that's been looked at. But then I'd also be looking at what else is going on in the belly? An 18-year-old cat, I mean, you could be dealing with intestinal cancer like intestinal lymphoma, you know, and other things that really need to be addressed. So if the kidney disease isn't that bad, then I'm looking at, you know, ruling out hyperthyroidism and then potentially going down the path of maybe getting an abdominal ultrasound done to be able to look at the intestinal tract and so on and see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. He didn't look at thyroid as far as I know. His bun creatinine was slightly elevated, so
yeah.
But he seems to be not over urinating. It's just his liquid diarrhea that was really amazing.
Yeah. So we should get a thyroid level checked. I mean, I look at that as standard. When I've got an elderly cat in that's getting routine blood work done, we get thyroids included with the chemistry. I mean, it's just that's how common hyperthyroidism is in cats.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Lynn. Appreciate your call. Jackie in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning. Hi, Larry. I'm glad you don't have a cold.
I had one for a long time.
Yeah. This does have I've been suddenly, after so many years of no medications, I've been putting on this, that, and the other thing. And it's take it in the morning, take it at night, antibiotics. And the thing that I'm wondering about is, does that apply to dogs? Does giving them an antibiotic at a certain time make it better for them? I've got a 10-year-old who's been having some problems. I've got a good vet, but I never thought to ask her.
Well, it really depends. Yeah, it really depends on the medication. There are some medications that have to be given on an empty stomach. There are some that do better given with a meal. There are some antibiotics that are once a day. There are some antibiotics that are twice a day.
Do dogs have the same problem when it comes to giving them, if you give them cheese or calcium or whatever?
It depends on the antibiotic. So there are some antibiotics that you have to be careful that you don't give them with dairy products and so on. But typically, you know, we're using dog food or something like that. If you had to give it in a little tinge of cheese to get them to swallow it, it's probably not going to make a big deal. But it really depends on the medication. So I think that, you know, when it comes time, if your dog ever does have to go on an antibiotic or any other medication, that would be something that your veterinarian would go over with you. You know, give it on an empty stomach, give it, you know, this one first, wait half hour before you give this one. I mean, there's some dogs that are on multiple medications and you literally have to set a timer to make sure that you get them in at the right times.
Yeah.
So everything can be, you know, on schedule. But, it, you know, so I wouldn't worry about it until the time comes for your dog.
Well, that's what I'm doing right now is trying to balance stuff at different times. And I wasn't sure. But I have a good vet, and I will ask her what happens.
All right. Thanks, Jackie. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest. Email from Kathy. Our 2-year-old Shih Tzu had a grand mal seizure less than 24 hours after she had her yearly shots. She weighs 7 pounds. We called her vet. He did not think the shots caused this. She recovered completely after a few hours. Was it caused by vaccinations? She's had her shots before without any problems. What should we do next year when it's time for shots?
Oh, good question. And I really, it's very unlikely that the seizures were due to the vaccine. Anything's possible. It could have just been the stress of being vaccinated triggered a seizure disorder. A lot of dogs with epilepsy will start seizuring right around 2 years of age. So this may just be epilepsy. But if the dog doesn't have any persistent neurologic signs, is totally back to normal, then, you know, again, it's something that you need to talk to your veterinarian about. A 7-pound Shih Tzu, that's tiny. Yeah. That is an itty bitty, you know, minuscule one. And I'd be really worried that as a young dog, does it have some other medical conditions such as, you know, some of these really tiny breeds will get liver shunts or, you know, the little pug nose pushed face dogs. Some of them will have problems with hydrocephalus where they've got too much cerebral spinal fluid on their brain. And so, you know, getting a really good physical exam done, if you haven't had blood work done to make sure that your dog's organs are functioning fine, that definitely needs to be looked into. I wouldn't just be blowing off, oh, your dog had a seizure, don't worry about it. I think that you need to go to the next level and get your dog in for a little bit more than just a physical exam. When it comes to next year for vaccines, I am a big believer in dogs that have had any potential for reactions, and I have no way of knowing whether the seizure was a reaction or not, of doing a procedure called titers, which is a blood sample to look at, is your dog well immunized? They look at antibody levels or proteins to these different diseases. And many dogs that have been vaccinated as a puppy a year later are often, you know, immunized for many of the viral things that we have to vaccinate for, rabies, distemper, and parvo, for many years, if not life. So that might be something that you can bring up with your veterinarian. I have clients that just want to do that. They just don't want to vaccinate. And I'm like, fine, we can do this. One of our doctors at the veterinary clinic now is doing titers, and it's actually less expensive to run a titer than it is to vaccinate dogs.
No.
So we can get titers now for $25 for distemper and parvo titer, and it's cheaper than vaccinating. So, you know, I think that would be something, again, to bring up with your veterinarian.
Ann in McHenry, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hello. I have a question about my dog's stinky paws. His feet smell, and I had thought about shampooing them, but that would require rinsing in a bucket. He's a big boy, and I can just see the mess from that. So I was looking at the waterless shampoo spray products where you spray it on and then just wipe it off. But I was concerned about him licking it, if that would be harmful to him.
Does he lick his feet right now?
No, he doesn't.
Okay. Is the skin between his feet red or irritated, moist?
No, not at all.
All right. You know, dogs shouldn't have smelly feet. You know, typically they should just smell like the rest of the body. So when there's an odor there, I start wondering if there's a secondary infection. And we will see dogs that have yeast infections between their toes and the pads of their feet. So before you start going out and just, you know, using shampoos or whatever to make your dog smell better, find out why there's an odor there first.
Okay.
And it's pretty easy. There's a couple of techniques that we use for collecting, I joke and I call it toe jam, but collecting toe jam. You can use crystal clear tape, like just like the tape you would put a use on a gift wrap, and take a piece of that and push it up against the skin between the toes, pull it off. You can stain it and have a look, and that collects a lot of the debris under there. You can take a little spatula and collect some of the debris. Sometimes if the dog is big enough and willing, you can just take a glass slide and push it up against the skin and collect enough material to have a look under the microscope. So that's where I would go first before I would start looking into bathing.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You're all welcome. Right.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Laura in Baraboo, on to you now. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have a Brittany Spaniel who is what I think is overly enthusiastic in the car. She loves going for rides, but she gets so hyped up, and she's panting, and she's drooling, and she's flinging drool all over the car. We travel a lot together, and I don't know if this is too stressful for her, if it's a result of anxiety or even a car sickness. I hate to not to bring her along, but it kind of drives me nuts.
Yeah, and it can be, and it may just be that she's just super excited. Sometimes dogs will drool more when they're nauseated. I assume she never vomits in the car?
Never vomits.
Okay. So
the only time it stops is when she stops to chew on a rawhide for a little while.
Okay, so she's comfortable enough to chew and play and do things like that. So it doesn't sound like she's too fearful. It may just be that she's just so hyped up. And a couple of things that I would recommend doing. In fact, I just watched a show, and I don't know whether you'd be able to find it, there's a British dog trainer, and I can't even remember what her name was, but she's on like Animal Planet or something. But
Victoria,
yes. Okay, I had fractured my ankle and was off work for a little bit last month, and put my foot up and was watching her show. And what she did, and I think this is a really good idea, is she has somebody driving, okay, and then somebody in the back seat with the dog. And you may not even be able to start the car. If the dog is super excited before you even start the car, then you have to, get over that first. But okay, she had them in the back seat and was, giving them treats and, doing things to, get the dog, just to sit down and relax. And, and then gradually they started moving down the highway. And I think that, if you could work with someone, and this is the problem, is it's not, you can't wait until you're going to go on a trip. This is going to be, got to be something that you work on, well before your trip, so you can get the dog, to know how to behave comfortably in the car. I'd also look at getting a seatbelt harness contraption, so that your dog is able to stay in one place. They can't pace back and forth. But again, the first time you use that, if the dog is a real spaz in the car, I've seen them get like flipped over and twisted up and so on because they're used to being able to move around. You need to have somebody sitting back there with the dog to keep the dog on a sit stay and be resting and comfortable.
That'd be something to practice before you actually got on the road, too.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, this sounds great. My vet had prescribed a puppy Valium, and you have to give it to him like an hour before you leave. So that was very impractical, and I never even tried it.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what drug they wanted to prescribe. Typically, many veterinarians will prescribe a drug called acepromazine, which is a sedative. And a lot of dogs will override that. We do sometimes just prescribe Valium for dogs, and that's used as an anti-anxiety drug. It doesn't sound like your dog is anxious. It sounds like you've just got a Brittany that's, just goes crazy because, boy, car rides are fun. So
there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor, clinical professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you for listening in here on the Ideas Net as we talk your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. I'm Larry Mueller. We have an email from Paula in Ashland who says we have an 11-year-old female spayed cat. We moved 3 years ago into a new home, doing fine, but she started clawing and ruining our furniture. Only the new Only the new furniture, not the old. She didn't scratch furniture in our other house. She has three scratching pads. I bought a collar that's supposed to calm her. Well, will it work?
Oh, well, the reason why cats scratch furniture is there's actually three reasons. One is that they're leaving their scent behind. So even cats that are declawed will still go up and rub their feet on vertical objects. Mm-hmm. The other reason is that they want to leave a visual mark as well. So the shredded fabric, whatever, that's leaving a clue that, you know, somebody walks into your house, they can say, ah, you have a cat. And the last reason is for honing their claws and grooming reasons. Where the couch is in your new home, I'm not sure what goes on outside the window or, you know, in the neighborhood, but she's marking. And so she's leaving this visual mark behind. And so something is triggering that. So what are you going to do? Well, number one, yes, you provided her with scratching pads and so on. They need to be in the location where she wants to scratch. So those need to be in the spot where the couch is so that she can direct the behavior to the appropriate item, the scratching pads or whatever. Sometimes cats, if you say you've got a pad for her, some cats like vertical scratching versus horizontal scratching. So you may want to look at, you know, if she likes those cardboard pads, you know, getting one of the ones that's elevated. I think they call it the Kitty Alpine Scratcher or something like that. That's got a little tilt to it at about a 45 degree angle. But finding a scratching post or something that is going to be similar in feel and shape and height as your couch is. And then you need to cover your couch up. Make sure that they can't see or smell the area that they've been scratching. Preferably move your couch to a different area, but if that's not possible, putting, you know, plastic over it, foil over it, something so that it's not going to be as friendly to her feet as the fabric is. And it may just be that the old furniture had a surface on it that she didn't like. The new furniture, ooh, you know, she's looking at that and going, wow, this shreds easily. It really holds my scent well. You finally got me the ultimate scratching post. So that may be what it came down to. So you're going to have to find the other ultimate scratching post for her and make sure it's not tippy and that, you know, it can shred easily as well.
Let's go to Mary in Milwaukee next. Mary, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Dr.
Hi.
Today.
I'm fine.
Great. So look, I've got one little wise tale to give you regarding cats that are not declawed as far as marking your furniture. One thing that we did was we got those cardboard boxes. They're corrugated. You can get them at any pet food store. And then what we did was we put catnip. We just impregnated it with catnip.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you that our cats, we have cats that are clawed and cats that are declawed. And the ones, both of them, all of them would have their turn on that box, and they have shredded. I can't tell you how many cardboard boxes versus shredding my furniture.
Well, good. But so your cats happen to like cardboard better than the furniture, and I'm just wondering with this other person whether the furniture is now more appealing than the cardboard, and that could be a problem. But yes, that's
a little catnip on it.
A little catnip, you know, that sometimes will attract the cat over there, but most cats in contact with catnip are going to roll, and it may not cause them to actually put their claws out. But a couple of things that this other person may want to try is if they're not comfortable with trimming their cat's nails, learn how to do it. And plastic nail caps, they make these things called soft paws that actually glue on, and they're easy to use, and that may help save the furniture as well.
Well, just a point in fact is my furniture is, I bought it knowing that the cats would probably mark it at some point, and true to form, they did.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That's
why I have leather furniture. I just decided, you know what, I'd rather deal with leather, and yeah, it gets, you know, their rear claws when they're taken off, digging in and so on, but hey, you know, that's part of having pets. Nothing's going to be perfect, but at least I don't have to worry about, you know, them shredding it. Yeah.
The reason that I'm calling, Doctor, is this. We have a, if you can believe this, a 29-pound cat. Her name is Fluffy, and Fluffy is a good name for her. She's a long-haired cat, and unfortunately, I think part of the problem is she does have those fatty tumors, which is what I think contributes to her weight. But we've tested for thyroid problems and kidney problems, but she drinks like a Green Bay Packer. She does use the litter box. However, because she's so big and she can't get back there to clean her feet, my husband has to clean her back paws for her, you know, when she gets out of the litter box.
Mm-hmm.
Can we try just maybe getting one of the diet cat foods for her to see if we can help her to lose some weight?
Yeah, she sounds like she's morbidly obese, and we do see cats getting lipomas, which are these small fatty tumors that kind of pop up here and there. They're not as common in cats as they are in dogs, but they're usually tiny and weighing a few grams, if that. So I don't think that, unless she's got a lipoma the size of her head on her body, there's no way that her lipomas, so you're kind of, you know, diluting think that that's what's causing the problem. She does need to go on a diet, and I think the best place to go is to your veterinary clinic. And your veterinarian can look back in her records and find out what her ideal weight would be. And so we'd go back and try to figure out, okay, this is what you weighed when you were about a year of age or so. And at that point, your body condition score was relatively normal. So that would be your ideal weight. And then they can figure out how many calories she needs a day. And it may even be that because she's so overweight, if she is not moving and exercising, she may need even less than what we would calculate out for most cats. Then it's a matter of turning that calorie number into the correct amount of food. And you're right, using a calorie restricted diet, there are several of them that you can get from your veterinarian, going over the counter and just buying a, you know, less active formula or weight control formula. Boy, if they're all over the board, ranging from anywhere from, you know, a little over like 250, 260 calories to well over 400 calories. So you have to know the food that you're using. There's a website that you can go to called petobesity.com that has about 12 pages of different dry cat foods, so you can actually see the ranges in the calories. But therapeutic diets for a cat that's morbidly overweight is probably the way to go. Therapeutic diets are going to be much higher in protein, lower in fat and carbohydrates. It's like the Catkins diet, as we call it. And feeding her that in a restricted, you know, she gets so much of this a day and that's it. You can't just free choice feed her. She'll just eat more of the lower calorie food and not lose any weight if you just free feed her. So it comes down to less food, more exercise, higher protein food, you know, and you having to live through all those months of having a cat that's bugging you to eat, and you having to substitute other things like play instead of food for love.
Yep. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have an email from Donna in Marquette, Michigan. We have an 8-year-old 70-pound Bouvier who suffered damage to a back leg cruciate ligament in January. At the time, she limped for a day. We kept her inactive for several weeks. She remains very active and fit, but we notice she sometimes shifts the leg around while she's standing in an effort to find a comfortable position. What are the pros and cons of surgical options?
Well, very rarely, if we have a dog with a torn cruciate, even if it's a partial cruciate, is rest going to make the joint back to normal? Damage has already been done. And so if you're seeing some atrophy on that side of the leg, if she's not using it quite as much, if you're starting to feel the difference between the knees, where maybe the affected leg, it's feeling a little thicker or bonier, or there's more joint effusion or joint fluid present, then I think surgery is definitely the way to go. There's several different surgical techniques. For a big dog like a Bouvier, you're looking at either a TTA, tibial tuberosity advancement surgery, which is one of the new ones, or there's another one that's called a TPLO, tibial planing leveling osteopathy or something like that.
Oh,
I'm sorry,
goodness.
TPLO. So, and these usually have to be done by veterinarians that are very well trained in orthopedic surgery. So your vet may be referring you to someplace else.
Bob in Wauwatosa, hello to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
It's too bad that you can't have Dr. Sawchuk on once a week, but I guess we're lucky we get her once a month.
I'd lose my voice for sure. Yeah.
Well, I have a question about canned pumpkin.
Okay.
A couple of years ago, our vet advised us to give him, he's an English Cocker Spaniel, and he's 10 and a half years old, and she advised us to start putting a tablespoon of canned pumpkin on his breakfast and dinner kibble. Well, we did that, and the anal gland plug-up problem largely disappeared. However, a friend of mine who has a book or read a book entitled "Good Old Dog," and I haven't read it, but this person said that the author of that book says something about canned pumpkin being good for dogs' joints. What can you tell us about that?
Well, pumpkin is really good in fiber. And so because it's a high fiber type of vegetable and it's kind of got a sweet taste to it, it's cheap, a lot of veterinarians will recommend throwing that, you know, a little bit of that on their food. The reason why it was added for your dog for anal gland issues is that that will bulk up the stool and put more pressure on the glands, causing them to empty when the dog has a BM rather than when they're scooting across your carpet. So that's probably why it was recommended. I don't know what would be in pumpkin to help joints. That would not be one of the foods that I would be recommending for joint care. But if it's worked for your dog, that's great.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for calling, Bob. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be with us until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along, and thank you again for listening. Join us with a question at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Steve in Escanaba, Michigan, has been waiting quite a while. So let's go to Steve. Thank you so much for calling, Steve.
Yeah, good afternoon. How's everybody today?
Just great. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind? I have a German race weenie that has problems. It looks like he's got like little pimples. Starts off on his backside, and it goes over his entire body.
So you have a dachshund?
Dachshund.
Okay. All right. You got me. You confused me there for a minute, and I'm like, what? Yeah. All right.
Yeah, so, he's a German race weenie.
Okay. So he's got little bumps along his back and down his sides?
Yeah, on his side. And my wife has taken him to the doctor, actually a couple of them, and they can't figure out what it is.
Okay.
Well, they're like pimples. And then after a day or two, he really starts stinking. So she has to give him a bath at least two times a week.
Well, there's a couple of things that come to mind. Dachshunds are very prone to, developing like blackheads and things. Schnauzers get them. I see it sometimes in dachshunds as well, where they'll get little comedones or blackheads along their back. And then, you know, just using a good anti-seborrheic shampoo will keep that under control. But I'm sure any veterinarian would have been able to diagnose that. It's quite typical. What it sounds like is if he's developing things that are coming up that look almost like a pimple and then they rupture and he's getting new ones, that he's got a skin infection, probably a staph infection. And when we're dealing with something like that, we're looking at, you know, using antibiotics. Treating topically is just going to be kind of part of the treatment. So using antibacterial shampoos that are usually chlorhexidine-based is what we typically use. So you'd have to get that through your veterinarian. But oral antibiotics and treating for the right length of time, the skin gets such a low amount of the blood supply that it takes a long time to clear up a skin infection. So we're usually looking at treating for at least a week post-cure. So once they're visibly 100% cured, you go for another week. So for many dogs, that means 3 to 4 weeks of antibiotics. But for long-standing deep infections, we may be looking at 6 to 8 weeks of getting the skin infection under control. So, you know, if you were to come in and see me, if I saw those little lesions on your dog's skin, I'd probably be taking a sample of one of them, either, you know, and just putting it on a slide and having a look to see if I can see bacteria. If you've been on antibiotics in the past with your dog and it's, you know, it's coming back again, then we start wondering, do we have a resistant bug here? Just like in the human world where we get a MRSA infection, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, which is a big problem in the human field. Dogs have their own individual staph. It's called methicillin-resistant staph intermedius. So that would be something we'd be culturing for to see if we've got the right antibiotic on board. So it may be time to go back to a veterinarian again.
Yeah, take a look. Thank you very much for calling, and good luck, Steve. Appreciate your call. Betty from Melrose, Wisconsin asks, I just heard you talking about pyrethrum products, and we did about 20 minutes ago or so. My vet gave me Adam's tick and flea spray as a repellent, which I have not used yet, and I'm glad because I also have a cat. And she's wondering, can this be sprayed on the dog during the day outside and be safe for the cat if it dries on the dog outside?
Yeah, you just don't want the cat to be coming in contact with the product while it's wet or in an area where you've just applied it and then the dog goes and lays down on the couch or the blanket and the cat lays there as well. So it probably would be safe. But, you know, these spray products, I just have gotten so away from using those because there's so many good spot-on, long-lasting products that cover the dog better and do a better job. The problem with sprays, especially permethrin-based sprays, there's pyrethrin, which doesn't last very long, and it's quite safe to use, but it doesn't work very well. And then there's a synthetic version of pyrethrin called permethrin. It's, you know, dosing them can be a real trick. How much do you put on the dog? How many sprays do you need to use to be able to have it cover them effectively? And that's where using the stuff that's in the pre-measured pipettes works so much better because you know you're giving your dog the right dose.
Let's turn to Beth in Brookfield next. Beth, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. How are you guys today?
Great.
We're fine.
Good. I am calling. We just adopted a kitten, and she just turned 4 months at the beginning of the month. She has a tendency that when she goes in her litter box that she steps in it, in her poop, and then kind of traipses it around the house.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also doing some butt scooting. And I'm wondering if there's something that we can do, I don't know, make the litter a little bit deeper, something else to kind of wean away from that.
Well, normal cat feces, why do we always get these calls at lunchtime? Okay.
Oh, no.
But normal cat feces should not be leaving any residue on her feet, okay? It should be firm. The litter should stick to it. But if she were to step in it, she would just put a dent in it, and that would be it.
Oh.
There shouldn't be anything, any residue left. So if her stools are soft enough that they are, you know, she's getting a little bit of residue on her rear end that's causing her to scoot, which may be why she's doing it, or that it's soft enough that she steps in it and tracks it around the house, I'd be looking at, you know, why has she got soft stools? By far, the number one reason in young cats is intestinal parasites. Things like roundworms, hookworms, giardia, coccidia. So taking in a fresh stool sample to your veterinarian would be in order. Also,
yep,
be
she did also just get worms.
Okay. But you know, make sure that they're using, if she's not getting better, there are lots of different dewormers out there. There's only one that is effective against giardia, and typically the kind of standard enthalmintics that we use do not get giardia. So and that's very, very common in kitties, and it can cause soft, mushy stool. So if she's not getting better, it's time to go, you know, call your veterinarian again, and they can do either some further testing on the stool or just jump into, you know, a response to therapy and see if she responds to a drug called fenbendazole. The other thing I'd be looking at is what you're feeding your cat. Sometimes cats that are ingesting a lot of milk will have soft stools, or if they're on a diet that just doesn't agree with them, that could be causing soft stools as well. So look at what you're feeding your kitty. If they're on a good commercial diet, they should be able to be producing normal stools. Lastly, I'd also be looking at your litter box management. The litter box needs to be 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to butt. So, you know, sometimes we'll go out and we'll buy these little itty bitty kitty litter boxes for kittens, and they outgrow them so quickly. So I like to use cement mixing trays, storage bins, like the tubs that are, you know, 4 or 5 inches tall that, you know, you can, you know, put under your bed or whatever, but are made out of plastic. And I tend to just walk right past all the standard litter boxes you can get at pet stores because they're just way too small, especially the covered boxes. Mm. Be careful about litter depth. If you start making it really deep, a lot of cats don't like deep litter. So every cat's an individual. I usually start with about 2 inches in the litter box and then see if the cat's a really heavy-duty digger. They may want a little bit more, but some cats would prefer a shallower litter box. So it's kind of just experimenting to find out. And I'd also make sure that you're scooping the box regularly so that she, you know, it's kept clean a couple times a day. And for one kitten, you should have at least 2 litter boxes. So
there you go.
Hopefully all that will help you with having clean floors.
And thanks for calling. And there's another Giardia question relating to a puppy this time from Diane, who recently purchased a puppy from a pet store. I learned it has Giardia. He's finishing his third treatment today, and I think he still has it. What do you recommend to permanently get rid of Giardia parasite? Is there a vaccine that'll help this puppy?
Yeah, there was a vaccine for Giardia. It did, but it's off the market. It's been off the market for a while now, and it did not cure a dog of Giardia. It just helped decrease the symptoms and the shedding of the organism. Big things for treating Giardia is that you need to make sure that you treat for the right period of time. And you will usually use a drug called fenbendazole for 5 to 7 days. And, you know, usually 5 days is adequate. Sometimes if dogs are really symptomatic, I'll also add in another drug called Flagyl, metronidazole, on top of it. And that sometimes just helps calm the gut a little bit. And it also has a little bit of antiprotozoal activity. It's not very effective for dogs, but we do use it once in a while in combination with fenbendazole. Last thing that you always want to do, or actually two last things. One is make sure you pick up the poop. Don't leave it laying around, especially if you've got a yard that's got any damp areas. That's where it's going to be happiest in wet areas around drains and so on. That's where the cysts like to live. And make sure that you wash your dog's bottom frequently, daily if you need to, feet and bottom, because if they have any fecal residue there, they're going to just get reinfected again. So hopefully with doing that, that'll get things under control. I also like to, with my Giardia cases, add in a probiotic. This is a bacteria food supplement type thing that there's a couple of them on the market. There's one called Prostora. There's another one called Fortiflora, made by two of the major pet food manufacturers that help re-inoculate the gut with healthy bacteria to get the dog's intestinal tract back to normal.
Let's go to Leah in Stoughton next. Hi, Leah. Thank you for calling.
Intestinal tract back to normal. Let's go to
Leah. Are you there? Let's try Paul in Grafton. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking the call. We have a 10-year-old husky with a pretty complicated medical history, but the immediate issue we have is she had an FHO surgery, if you know what that is, a hip surgery last, I'm going to say fall sometime, we're not quite sure when. She was doing fine on her recovery, but then started to show pain on movement. So we took her in for x-rays. It showed she'd been laying down bone. So the decision, and then she had bone on bone contact. She'd been laying down bone on each, on both the pelvis and the femur.
Okay, why did she have a femoral head and neck osteotomy is what this FHO stands for, and it's if you were to kind of look at a dog or a human skeleton, it's the ball part of the femur or the you know upper leg bone that is removed. So that and if you were to do that to a human, your leg, if you stood on it, would end up in your armpit. But because dogs are the way they're built, it just ends up moving up a little bit and forms a false joint in the pelvic musculature. And you shouldn't have bone-on-bone contact, but this is a surgery that we typically don't recommend for big dogs. And so if she's a good-sized husky, that may not have been an appropriate surgery to have done.
Yeah, we were told 50 pounds and over is not recommended.
Yeah.
A 40-pound dog.
Okay, so she's kind of right on that cutoff point. Yeah, did they do any x-rays postoperatively to see if they removed enough of the head and the neck of the femur?
Well, that was when she started to show the discomfort, we did the x-rays and it found out that there was still bone-on-bone contact.
Okay.
And so we talked to another surgeon who said that he thought he could repeat the surgery or do another surgery and actually get her relief. We did the surgery. During the surgery, they did find a sarcoma.
Ooh.
Which the surgeon said he could not remove, but pathology came back and said it really was not a particularly, first of all, it didn't look to be advanced, according to the surgeon, and pathology said it was not a particularly fast-growing sarcoma.
Okay.
So we were told that you really can't do her post-op rehab like we had done the first time,
mm-hmm.
stretching and range of motion things, but that she should recover just fine, and the sarcoma probably wasn't going to be the limiting factor on her lifetime.
Okay, okay.
About 3 months ago, her appetite started to decline rapidly, and then about 2 months ago, she just quit eating.
Okay.
Just stopped. So we've been tube feeding her, or syringe feeding her since then, and luckily my wife is a nurse, so we give her sub-Q fluids every other day.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's happy, she's perky, she loves to take walks, she loves to play with the other dogs in the neighborhood, but she will not eat.
Yeah. You know, I really worry about a dog with a sarcoma. Is it something that has metastasized to other places? I'm not sure if you're doing follow-up chest rads or anything like that, but there's an excellent website that just came online that is made by two board-certified veterinary oncologists. The website is called VET small letters and then capital letters cares, CARES.com, vetcares.com. It's a site that really helps owners that have pets with cancer navigate through all the process of like diagnosis and treatment. It has a cancer dictionary. So if people are listening and they're like, what's a sarcoma? I don't know what that is. You can just click on, you know, in the dictionary, sarcoma, and that'll tell you what it is. It helps talking about quality of life issues. It deals with nutritional issues that you need to be addressing when cats or dogs that have cancer, and not just dogs, but dogs and cats and other pets as well. How to know when the pet is exhibiting pain and things. That's what, you know, I'm really concerned about with your dog is, you know, why is it not eating? Is there something else going on metabolically? Has it spread to her liver where it's making her feel nauseated? Is it, you know, does she have, on board, kidney disease on top of it? So, are there metastasis in her lungs? I would expect she wouldn't be able to exercise or do that kind of stuff. But, I think she needs to have further workup, and not sure what your veterinarian's been recommending, but dogs should eat, and if she's not, then you got to find the reason why.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Karen from Baraboo. She wanted to share an unusual diagnosis that she got with her cat. It's stomatitis. And her cat was allergic to its own teeth enamel.
It's not that uncommon.
Yeah, steroids didn't help, but pulling the teeth did.
Yep.
And the cat's doing very well now.
She
was wondering how common it was.
Yeah, it's actually fairly common. And it's not the cat is developing an allergy or whatever to their enamel. It's more the plaque, the normal material and bacteria in the mouth. The cat becomes plaque intolerant. And, brushing the cat's teeth, most cats don't see the humor in that. And what ends up happening is you get these horrible red, bleeding, painful gums. And if you just do a, total mouth extraction, it's amazing. These cats are back to normal very quickly. They're eating, they're pain-free. It's not something nice to have to go through initially, but it does give them wonderful, good quality of life for the rest of their life.
And Robert in Wadsworth, Illinois, says his dog, his border collie, loves peanuts and peanut butter, which he gives her only occasionally and sparingly. Is that okay, or is there a danger for dogs with peanut products?
No, if they're safe, if it's been safe for people, then it should be safe for dogs. Every once in a while, you will see, recalls on peanut butter and things like that because there's been, some fungal toxin or something like that got into the mix. So you have to, watch your news. And if there's a recall on the brand of peanut butter you're using, then obviously you don't eat it, and the dog doesn't eat it. I have to admit, my dogs every morning get their a peanut butter bone. I have. A rawhide bone, which they rarely ever chew, and I put a little smear of peanut butter on the end, and it gives me 15 minutes of peace so I can drink my tea and read my paper, and they just lay in their crates and lick and lick and lick and lick, but never chew on the bone. So even as a veterinarian, I use it. But rule of thumb with using peanut butter is it's high in calories, so if your dog is overweight or has any gastrointestinal distress from the extra, fat and so on that's in peanut butter, then obviously don't use it.
And let's go to Judy and Racine next. Judy, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks so much for your program. We have a 4-year-old terrier mix. He's a rescue. We've had him 3 years. And when he poops, he cries. It obviously hurts him. And sometimes his stool is the size of a nightcrawler, you know, very small. And this has been going on about 9 months. He's been to see 2 different vets. They have checked the stool samples. They've done digital exams. We've tried high fiber, and now he's on IM's intestinal low-residue veterinary formula. And he's still having a problem, and I don't know what to do for the poor little guy.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like if his stool was in the past normal, now it's become this tiny little, you know, ribbon of stool coming out.
Yesterday it was normal.
Okay. I start wondering, you know, does he have some type of, you know, obstructive disease or something like that going on? Have they talked to you about doing any, like, imaging, like, barium enemas to see if he's got a stricture or having any problems, or an ultrasound of his abdomen? That may be your next step.
Okay.
Going that way. I agree. I think he needs to be, if he's having that much trouble passing stool, let's have him make as less, you know, least amount of stool as possible. And that's where the low residue diet's going to come in handy. But I really worry that there might be some kind of obstructive type problem. It's funny in that it's intermittent. And, you know, usually if dogs have something obstructing, it's like they've got a big prostate, they've got an intestinal tract tumor, they've had a fractured pelvis, and there's, you know, the bone is pushing up on the colon. You know, there's usually something, you know, weird that way, and it's not going to just come and go. So that may be what's causing your vets to be stumped. But I think probably a little barium enema, which is not the most pleasant thing, but maybe the way to go.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. And an email from Patty from Almond, Wisconsin. We have a wonderful lab golden retriever mix who has an interesting problem. She howls and sings every time she hears the theme from the TV show MASH. And only when she hears MASH. Is she just singing along, or is there some note or tone that hurts her ears? I want to turn down the TV when it comes on if it hurts her, but leave it for her to enjoy if she is just singing along.
Well, I think you have to kind of look at your whole dog's body language. If she's wagging her tail and her ears are up and, you know, it's just like, woo, you know, yay, I like doing this. But if, you know, if she's acting distressed and is trying to hide behind the sofa and you know, then obviously something's bothering her. It's hard to say. Maybe you need to talk to an animal communicator or something and try to find out what's going on. But
look at the behavior, though.
At the behavior. Yeah, kind of look at her whole body language. What's her tail doing? What are her ears doing? And, you know, are her pupils getting wide? Or is she, you know, is she showing any signs of being in distress?
And how do you pill a dog?
I love pill pockets. If the dog can take pills with food, the company that makes Greenies have these things that look like little shot glasses. They're really squishy. You can hide it in there. So hiding it in food's the best way. If not, you open the mouth and push it down.
Push it down and rub the throat little bit?
Yeah, get them to swallow.
Oh, man. Well, I tell you what, this has been a lot of fun. And you're coming back.
May 10th.
And I should mention that you're going to be off now. You're heading out to Colorado.
I am for a few days. So if anybody that's going to be emailing me, I'll get back to you next week. Yeah, I don't take work with me when I'm on vacation.
I don't blame you a bit.
Okay.
Have a lot of fun, Sandy.
I will.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest. She is a professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, and she'll be back in about a month, and we will do this all over again. Just to take a look at tomorrow's shows, tomorrow after 11, I'll be talking with Kent Hall, also known as Dr. Bluebeard, Bluebird. He'll tell us about some efforts to protect and support those lovely birds. And check our Facebook page. There's a wonderful little poem written by a woman about her dog who departed. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. Thank you for listening.